top executives and crazy entrepreneurs gather to talk about the future of electric vehicles. This is the Driving with Dunn podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Driving with Dunn podcast. I am your host, Michael Dunn. This week, our special guest is John Pomfret, author of a terrific new book entitled From Warsaw with Love. Wait, that sounds a little bit like a John Le Carre thriller, right? We might also call the book The New Great Game. What? Okay, hang on. If you're wondering what this book has to do with electric cars, just stay with me a minute. You see, Poland has become a crucial ally to the United States, never more crucial than today as Russia continues its onslaught into Ukraine. But there's more. Poland's spy agency also has deep institutional memory when it comes to China, America's number one adversary. Electric cars, yes, China would love to transform Europe, among other things, into a continent of consumers happily buying Chinese-branded electric cars. Okay, there's a lot going on there, I get it. But the big picture idea is at the heart of Europe, America counts on Poland in ways that are immeasurably important to America's national interests. Now, a little bit more about John. I've known him for years. He's tremendous on China. He was one of the first American students to go to China in the early 1980s. He speaks and writes Chinese fluently. He also speaks, are you ready for this, Japanese, French, and Croatian. John's landmark book, The Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom, traces the relationship with the United States and China over the last 220 years. It's a relationship that shifts from wonderfully warm to icy cold and back over and over and over again. Now his new book brings a new dimension, revealing a special spy relationship between the United States and Poland and how that relationship is pivotal to America as it battles both Russia and China for great power influence across Europe. John Pomfret, author, From Warsaw with Love.
The Daily Drive podcast brings you all the news you need to know to keep up in the auto industry. I'm Jamie Butters, executive editor of Automotive News.
And I'm Kellen Walker. We give you all the top stories each weekday in interviews with experts like Mike Dunn explaining Jeep struggles in China.
How bad did it get as recently as June? Sales of Jeeps in China. Can you guess the number, Jamie?
Oh, gosh. Was it four digits?
It was one digit. And the number was one.
Listen and subscribe to Daily Drive at autonews.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
John Pomfret, welcome to the Driving with Dunn podcast.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Thank you for taking time. So much to talk about, so much happening in the world today, but let's begin local. You are today in Berkeley, California, correct?
Yes, indeed. Yes.
And when I think of Berkeley, I think of bikes and skateboards. I don't think of cars, but I could be wrong. How do you get around?
We actually do have cars in Berkeley. They're still allowed by the city council. Yeah, any day now it could end. But yeah, we get around actually mostly in four-wheeled vehicles. Yes. There's a sort of metastasization of scooters, which are everywhere and sometimes extremely dangerous. Obviously, we have a lot of bicyclists and skateboarders as well. Recently, one skateboarder was very ambitious and tried to go down Marin Avenue, which, if you'll remember, is extremely precipitously steep, and going down there, and he actually hit the Arlington Circle and ended up breaking several of his limbs. But that's Berkeley for you.
Right, that is Berkeley, right? Let it rip. Let it go wild, baby.
Exactly.
Hopefully that person had a helmet on.
I think he might have.
Okay. What if you were to get an electric car, which brand would you choose?
So I had an electric car, actually, at least one, and I had a BMW i3, which I really loved a lot, simply because it's basically the Berkeley version of a sports car for a middle-aged man. So, and you see a lot of them around Berkeley driven by middle-aged men like me. And the reason why I liked it is it didn't have a great range, about 150 miles, but it was totally useful for anything local. And it handled remarkably well. And the regenerative braking gave you the sense like you were driving a stick shift. Like you can downshift basically by taking your feet off the gas, which I thought was really fun.
That is fun. It is like downshifting. I remember as a kid, my dad dropping it from fourth to third to second, and just the charge of energy that came through the body when the car is downshifting. And then we got a little bit of that same flavor with the regen.
Exactly. And then also the fun thing is like basically going out to drive and you basically don't have to put your foot on the brake. And the whole thing is if you know how to drive the car well, you never actually have to touch the brake.
So where is that gem today?
I've returned it and now I'm pondering another purchase of, actually this time a purchase of an EV, but I've yet to really make my decision.
Okay. You have any finalists?
I'm looking at the Kia UV6.
Mm-hmm. That's a sweet ride.
It's a sweet one, but the problem is I don't like that tiny rear view, you know, the rear mirror. It's the rear window. It's just too small because I like to look at who's coming behind me. Yeah. So I'm thinking elsewhere, but I've test driven it and I really like it. It handles really nicely. Not quite as nicely as the BMW, but pretty good.
That and its twin, the Hyundai Ioniq 5, both very good cars.
Yeah,
you can't go wrong.
Yeah, same platform, right?
All right, we're here today to talk a little bit about cars, but mainly to talk about you, author of three different books, most recently From Warsaw with Love. But before we get into the books, I wanted to ask you, when did you first knew you wanted to build a career as a foreign correspondent?
So I started college wanting to be a neurophysiologist, and then I confronted chemistry, and chemistry beat me. And then I began to study social sciences, humanities, history, anthro, econ, and really got into it. And this was in the late 70s when China was becoming a big issue. So I was on the front page of the New York Times as we went through the process of normalizing our relations. There was that, you know, Nixon secret trip to China. All of that was just happening at the time. And I really got caught up in the excitement about discovering this new country. And over the course of time of going to China, going other places overseas, I came to the conclusion that I really like to travel a lot and I could write decently well enough. And I began to think, well, why not try to put those two together and create a career out of it? And luckily I was gifted enough and got enough breaks and the support of mentors to really put it together and do it.
So many times I see that you are in the right place at the right time. How many different countries have you lived in?
In terms of actually living, probably about 12.
Mm-hmm. Which one is the most dangerous?
Afghanistan was pretty bad and Bosnia was bad. So I was in Afghanistan off and on for over the course of 3 years from 89 to 92 before the 9/11. And it was a very messy place, factionally split up, a lot of different tribes running different areas. You never really knew which side was safe. And then I spent a lot of time in Kabul, which was bombarded on a routine basis by rockets from Mujahideen forces that were based outside the city. And then Bosnia in 92 to 96, I was there for 4 years during the height of the civil war.
As a foreign correspondent on the ground in places like Afghanistan or Bosnia, you go outside in the morning to cover what you need to cover. What do you wear? How do you protect yourself? How do you not get killed?
So in Afghanistan, we didn't really have at the time flak jackets and that kind of stuff. We just had to use our smarts. By the time Bosnia rolled around in the early 90s, we began wearing flak jackets simply because there was so much sniper activity in Sarajevo. They could not necessarily even be targeting you. They just would be targeting normal people in the population. And so if you just were out there unprotected with no helmet and no flak jacket, you could get killed. Even with a flak jacket, you can get hurt. But nonetheless, it really did protect you to a certain extent. You know, and then we invested in an armored car. Although the armored car that the Washington Post had was an old refurbed Land Rover, which they basically covered the cab itself in protective coating of armor, but they didn't cover the back. And so the whole weight balance in the vehicle was so screwed up that if you hit a patch of, for example, black ice in the winter, the back of the truck wanted to go around and meet the front of the truck. And so often it became far more dangerous even to have the armored car because of the balance. It wasn't a fully armored vehicle, which was, you know, the weight was centered and et cetera. So that always became a challenge. And I remember in late 1995, after NATO had deployed in Bosnia, crashing the car into the back of a parked vehicle by accident. But when the impact happened, I felt this internal joy that I no longer would have to drive this car ever again, because I was convinced that it was going to kill me and not a sniper's bullet.
Okay, that's a debate with oneself that one could only hear from someone who's been there and done that. Like, okay, I'm extremely terrified of bullets. Hold on, no, I'm even more terrified of this vehicle I'm set up with. So
exactly.
Yeah. Okay, but you made it. You made
it. I did. Luckily. Yeah.
All the way through to your third book, From Warsaw with Love, which was published last year. And as I said, right man, right time, right place. You could not have known that that book would be coming out at months so close to the invasion of Ukraine.
No, it was not timed.
Just coincidence.
Completely. Yeah.
All right. So From Warsaw with Love, immediately my mind goes to James Bond and spies. So what's going on? Who's Warsaw loving, or what happened there?
So this book tells the story of how Poland got into NATO. And basically, there's the 1989 change, the Berlin Wall falls, et cetera. And Poland, which had been part of the Soviet bloc, is sort of out there by itself looking for some type of security in the face of this really rapidly changing world. And the Poles begin to conclude that if you're not going to be belonging to Moscow, then you better belong to Washington. And the first group in Poland that really came to that conclusion were not the Polish dissident community, but actually the Polish foreign intelligence officers who had been posted overseas, been posted in the West, knew the advances and the strength of the West, and basically came to the conclusion that Poland needed to create an alliance with the United States. And the story that this book tells is how Polish operatives helped the CIA in a variety of places around the world, and therefore got the CIA on Poland's side when it came to expand NATO. And Poland was in the first entry class, along with the Czech Republic and Hungary, to join NATO, to expand NATO.
Well, that's a really fascinating point, because the dissidents, the people who were fighting against the communist regime in the first place, weren't the first to embrace the United States. Instead, it was the entrenched spy agency.
Well, they embraced the United States. They had there was a significant group of the dissidents who had these very sort of idealistic views of maybe Poland could be, along with the Czech Republic and Hungary, sort of a third way.
Non-aligned
between the East and the West. And, and it was somewhat romantic. And the spies were far more cold-blooded about it and said, well, look, if we're not going to belong to Moscow, we better be supported by Washington. Mm. And in the light of history, they were absolutely correct.
Absolutely correct. Yeah. And here we are with Ukraine, and immediately days after the invasion, thousands of Ukrainians flooding across the border to Poland, and Poland welcoming those.
Yeah, we have millions now of Ukrainians living in Poland.
Millions.
They've taken the brunt of the refugee crisis that's been caused by Putin's invasion.
One of the points you made in your book was that being an ally to the United States as a smaller country has its good points and bad points. The good point being, oh, nice, big, cozy, friendly America. But there's another side to it, right?
Yeah, exactly. As a Polish politician said to me, basically being America's ally is kind of like being married to a hippopotamus. So in the beginning, as you said, it's cozy and comfortable. Then the hippo turns and crushes you and doesn't even notice. And Poland has faced those issues with America over the course of the 20 plus 30 years since the 1989 changes.
Crushes you and doesn't even notice. Probably the most painful part of that is doesn't even notice.
Right. Well, it is a small country, but the reality is it's boxing above its weight in many ways. I mean, it is the frontline state involving Putin's war in Ukraine. And because it's been such a very strong NATO member, I think it's played a significant role along with the Biden administration in concentrating the minds of the Europeans, mm-hmm. the French and the British, and particularly the Germans on the threat faced by Putin. And if Poland hadn't been in NATO, I think it would have been more difficult for Biden to unite the NATO alliance to counter the threat. And the Poles have been really very upfront and forward thinking about this, the challenges faced by Putin's war on the Ukraine.
What do the Poles think now, today, 2022, end of Where's this thing in Ukraine headed next? And what are the implications for us in the West?
Well, I think, you know, the issue is that if we begin to weaken in our support, and the polls are very worried that the main countries of the West, particularly the Germans, but also perhaps even the United States, will weaken in their support of the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian people. And that's a significant concern in Poland, because if they do that, then it will ultimately end up rewarding Putin's aggression. And then the concern is, okay, what's next, right? Is Moldova next? Mm. Are the Baltic states next? Will Putin challenge the whole NATO issue and, you know, create an Article 5 or Article 6 problem where NATO will be forced to respond? But if we're weaker, that's what they're really concerned about. And so they've been very far in front trying to head off the possibility of that happening. Mm-hmm. So that's their concerns. Question is, do we have the wherewithal to keep supporting Ukraine?
It gets complicated in a hurry. I'm thinking you mentioned Germany in particular. You know, arguably Germany's been the most reluctant or least enthusiastic about getting involved. And so I think to myself, is there a China factor at play here?
Well, for the U.S., definitely, right? I mean, because it's very clear that Xi Jinping is looking at how the Western alliance is holding or not holding as he figures out his calculus about what ultimately to do with Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's the model. Right. And so and from the U.S. perspective, how the alliance holds together or doesn't vis-a-vis Ukraine will be an important signal. And they understand that to China as China mulls the possibility of taking military action to reunite or unite with Taiwan.
You've lived in China. You speak fluent Mandarin. You know, China is what your second book, A Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom. Phenomenal. Phenomenal history of the relationship between China and the United States between 1776 and today. What is your take on, let's just talk about Taiwan for a moment. Taiwan in 2030, what does it look like?
So, great question. Yogi Berra once said, it's really difficult to predict the future, especially about the future. But that said, I think I'm concerned that, you know, in China, there's a lot of, you know, Xi Jinping came into power 10 years ago, speaking about what he called the rejuvenation of the Chinese people. And I am particularly concerned that that phrase rejuvenation is increasingly synonymous with the idea that the PRC wants to and needs to unite with Taiwan in order to be fully rejuvenated. And that would probably involve some type of kinetic military action. And that's what I'm concerned about. So up to 2030, I'm particularly concerned in the late 2020s into 2030, the potential, I think, for the PRC to make a move on Taiwan increases. I think Xi Jinping looks at the prospect of reuniting with Taiwan as an important, a key part of his political legacy. Right. I mean, Chairman Mao united the country, united China. The Chinese people under him stood up. And I think that Xi Jinping thinks that sort of the capstone or the icing on that cake would be his move to reunite with Taiwan, sort of the final reunification of the Chinese people under Xi Jinping. And that type of political goal, I think, is somewhat something that they could very well pursue up to or even after 2030. And so that's now, if the U.S. continues in its strong support of Taiwan, if other European powers and Japan and Australia can be involved again in helping Taiwan figure out how to best defend itself, then I think the potential for that is less. But the important thing is that the alliance that the U.S. has in Asia need to be strong, and there needs to be a lot of support, not just American support, but a lot of other support for Taiwan. And that's a big open question.
The words, how you put it in a recent talk, you said America's a superpower in large part because of our alliances, not in spite of them.
Right. So this goes back to the whole Ukraine situation, right? Mm-hmm. Without Poland, we would have had a much weaker case to make with our other partners about mm-hmm. the necessity of hanging together. And so I think that's similar in Asia as well. So you see the Biden administration pushing AUKUS, the Australia-UK defense agreements, pushing the Quad, which is an organization between India, US, Japan, and Australia, pushing these type of multilateral organizations to become stronger in order to help us help them.
If Taiwan is the short-term goal, what's the larger goal? What does China want?
So I think under Xi Jinping, I think what China wants has evolved and accelerated in terms of its ambition. So I think in terms of geostrategic issues, I think the PRC wants the United States out of the Western Pacific. There would be happy.
Out of the Pacific.
Out of the Western Pacific. Not out of the Western Pacific. So we can go back to Hawaii, basically.
Okay.
And I think that they view the Western Pacific as their lake, similarly to how they're treating the South China Sea as their lake, even though it goes all the way down to the coast of Vietnam, far down to the Malaysian boot, but they believe that that's their lake. And I think their views are expansive and expansionist, and they think that they should push past the first island chain, push past Guam and Taiwan, and basically control that area because they are the big residential continental power there. And they believe that that really rightly belongs to them. And the United States doesn't believe so, but I think that their goal is ultimately to replace America as the resident power in Asia. And I think that's that. And then in terms of continental issues, right. I mean, they actually have been remarkably successful in basically dealing with all of their neighbors except for India. And so I think that's in terms of land disputes. And I think that's a potential coming hot spot as well. You see, they routinely beat each other up with clubs and sticks along the border. And that type of problem is not going to get smaller over time. It will get more intense over time as India flexes its muscles and China does so as well.
All right. The Asian countries, for example, Singapore, Thailand, Indonesia, they don't like to have to choose between the U.S. and China. They say so publicly. By the same token, they shudder at the thought of, wait a second, what if the United States is completely gone from the Western Pacific? What then? Then you've got historical animosities between China and Japan, between Vietnam and China, between India and China. So it could get messy in a hurry.
Exactly. So, and it's that relatively contradictory position that a lot of these other countries face is like the Singaporeans, right? I mean, they make a huge amount of money in their business and investments in China. And they're a hub now for PRC engineers who have fled China because of COVID, using their entrepreneurial smarts to create really great companies based in Singapore. At the same time, the Singapore ports are completely open to U.S. warships, right? And there's a basically full-time American deployment in Singapore, even though it's not on the books, right? And so, and Singapore is a perfect example of the nations in Southeast Asia basically trying to walk this very fine line between being pro-American for security, but being pro-China for their bottom line.
Pro-American for security, pro-China for the money.
The money, exactly.
Dilemma. One more question here, short term, and then we're going to pull the lens back. And that is, if you're an American company operating in China today, what's your plan?
So it kind of depends on what area you're operating in. But nonetheless, I think that the economic relationship has been and will increasingly be buffeted by the politics of the relationship. So if you're in semis, if you're in AI, if you're in medical devices, if you're in all sorts of areas that touch on high tech, you could increasingly be in the crosshairs of either the PRC in order to try to get your intellectual property or the United States government that's worried about whether your investments are supporting the bolstering of China's surveillance state or its military. And I think that the politicization of this economic relationship is something that's going to accelerate with time. We already have CFIUS in the United States, which is the organization that looks at Chinese investment, well, foreign investment in America. But there's a lot of talk in Congress now of flipping it and having an outbound CFIUS about whether a Treasury Department organization should be monitoring investments in potential adversarial countries like China in order to stop them from profiting from American capital. So I think that in increasingly this type of issue, this politicization of the economic relationship is going to happen and it's going to become more intense with time.
More intense over time. So there isn't a sense, oh, there's a storm, the storm will pass. If we take the big arc of U.S.-China relations, I think there's no one better to comment on that than you, because your book begins, I believe, in 1776. That's how long ago the United States started to have connections with China, what we know as China.
Right. So I think the new issue now, I mean, obviously the relationship has has had this sort of cyclical quality of huge expectations, dashed expectations, you know, crashing down to real significant enmity, followed by huge expectations again. But I think that, the new issue in the relationship is that China is now a strong country. Whereas over the course of the 250 some odd years of US-China relations, China had never been in that position, except in the beginning of the relationship with the, when the Qing dynasty had yet to really fall on its sword in front of British imperialism, et cetera. But now China is actually strong. And that is a new element of the relationship that the United States has never confronted before. And I don't think the current trough that we are in is going to be a passing phase. I think we're in it for a significant period of future, barring any type of significant change in China. And that could happen. You never know. Mm-hmm. China, by its very nature, being an authoritarian state, is somewhat unstable. And, you know, it's very difficult to tell, you know, if anything radical could happen in China, but it could, right? Because it's a one-man dictatorship. And if he suddenly disappears, all bets are off, right? Now, the chances are that he's going to disappear are very low, but by its very nature, it's a more unstable system than that of ours.
Arguably the most unpredictable powerful country in the history of humanity. I mean, we had zero COVID.
Right.
And then, oops, okay, green light, we're opening
right.
up.
Extraordinary, right? Really extraordinary.
This, for a billion plus people.
Right. In the past couple of weeks have been really extraordinary. And with now with a what they call a R-naught factor of about 16, which is almost, I mean, more, you know, it's basically it's like one person will get 16 people sick. Whereas at the height of our problem about 18 months ago with Omicron, we were R factor of 10. So it's significant problems that they're facing throughout the country.
Let's talk about your own personal relationship with China. When did you first go to China and what did it feel like when you arrived?
So I first went there in September of 1980, the sort of second group of American kids to go study. And Beijing, the thing I remembered about Beijing was just the enormity of the sky in Beijing, because there were no buildings above six stories. I mean, way downtown in Beijing, there was the Beijing Hotel, which was like, depends on how you count them, but sort of 12 stories tall. But I was in the northwest corner of the city, and there just were nothing. And so this sky was just massive. And there was a little pollution. There was this band because of the coal dust that would, you know, basically at the horizon. But the enormity of the sky was something that really impressed me. And then, of course, it was just all the bicycles. And not just the bicycles, but the horse-drawn carts, the donkeys. I mean, it was a sense of literally going back in time. And it just really struck me. And then the colors, right? The only clothes that you would see that were reds and blues, reds and sort of yellows, et cetera, were on kids, because everyone else was wearing blue and green. And so that kind of sense of this monochromatic sort of feel with this massive, you know, underneath this massive blue sky and the silence of the streets, because everyone's riding bikes. And so the loudest sound you would hear were the occasional bike that had a bell on it, because a lot of the, you know, they had a shortage of bells, but a few of the bicycles had bells. And that was it. So there was this quietude to the place that was really striking.
You mentioned the quiet. Yes, I remember my very first day, Chengdu, 86, looking at the hotel Sunday morning, 6 a.m., and there was an ocean of bicycles heading down the main avenue, but you didn't hear anything. It was just like someone turned the sound off. It was just thousands of souls cruising along on their bicycles, but no sound.
Right.
Yeah, that was remarkable. What about the people themselves? How were you received at the time? How were you viewed as an American?
So there was this intense curiosity because they'd been told for decades that we were the, you know, not, they didn't use the expression, the great Satan. That's Iran's expression. But they, you know, we were enemy number one, I mean, along with the Soviet Union, right? And so, but there was a huge amount of curiosity about America, because at the same time that they were told we were the enemy, they'd also heard from their friends and their relatives and their grandparents that we were actually the one who saved them from the Japanese. And so there was this very deeply contradictory emotions they had about the United States, which they created this really powerful sense of curiosity. And so, and the warmth that the average person expressed towards me was really mind-boggling, which changed over time, right? I mean, America's no longer, you know, they're no longer curious about the United States. They already made the decision that we're out to contain them, right? And but back in the day, they didn't see it from that perspective. And then as time passed and the United States and China literally basically forged what became an alliance against the Soviet Union, the relationships got even closer. But then, of course, things changed and things, you know, people became more cynical and their propaganda became more successful. And the U.S. did things that were, you know, arguably foolish with the China that changed the nature of the relationship as well.
What has the U.S. done wrong or gotten wrong about China?
I think the underlying issue was the Americans approached China with a sense of kind of a lot that was the American approach to China was deeply influenced by the ideology of the missionaries in the Christian missionaries in China who came to China with this desire to remake China somehow in America's image. And I think the belief that America could do that has colored significantly how America has approached China. And that many American officials were kind of more willing to give China benefits now in exchange for a future province of better behavior later. And the relationship was less transactional than it should have been. And if it had been more transactional, our expectations for China would have been lower and the playing field would not have gotten so a-kilter from the beginning. And it's really difficult to create a reciprocal relationship from a very unreciprocal relationship that has gone on for decades. If you start with a level playing field, it's hard. Then you can police that. But if you immediately start where the playing field is not level and writing, it becomes a lot more difficult. And I think that's caused a significant amount of problems in the relationship in the current day. Because the Chinese got used to getting a good deal from the United States. Mm-hmm. And so when America attempted to rewrite the nature of the relationship, it became very difficult because the Chinese could argue, rightly so, hey, we've been doing it like this for decades. Why change now?
Perfect illustration of that is China's accession to the WTO,
right?
Where China negotiated very hard to enter as a, you know, less developed economy and would have access to U.S. markets while at the same time being allowed to largely protect its own home market. And the United States would have thought, oh, and we know the architects of that agreement on the U.S. side have said, we did this with the intentionally to allow them to join the global economic community. And over time, they would come to see the benefits and become more reasonable and open up. That second part just hasn't happened. That's the right problem. That's what they're talking about.
They pocketed the benefits, and in the end of the day, they didn't kind of own up to the spirit of the law.
Do you feel, John, that the Chinese are very smart, very sophisticated negotiators? They have long history. They're no dummies. Do you feel as though when they stepped into the WTO, they felt as though we know what the Americans are trying to do, but we'll just take what we can take now, and we'll may or may not reciprocate later?
Yeah, clearly, I think that they were very cognizant of what they were getting into. And they understood that how significantly it would benefit their economy, and it really did. And they understood that the promise of future change, they didn't need to keep to it. So they benefited. I mean, you know, this wonderful expression, right? The Chinese like to use this expression, win-win, right? And then, you know, some cynics will say, well, yeah, that actually means China wins twice. I think the Americans got caught out on that because they trusted in the ability of the United States to change China. Again, back to the missionary, this kind of naive sense that China was somehow plastic in the hands of an American forger. Yeah,
that's Jonathan Spence, right? To Change China.
Right. Amazing book.
Yeah. All right, so win-win, back to that. Yes, I can't tell you the number of executives I walked out of a meeting with and they say to me, did you hear what they said? Win-win. They get us. They understand. There's trade-offs. There's reciprocity. And it's hard for me to say, hold on.
Right.
Those were the words they used, but what did they mean?
Right.
May not be exactly what you think.
Right.
Uh-huh. Where to then for, we talked about U.S. companies, what plans they might be making. Is there an option for the United States to pivot now and strengthen its economic and diplomatic and security ties with the rest of Asia? Is that going to work
I think that's what the Biden administration wants to do. But to your point, Michael, it's unclear whether it's going to work. I mean, so take semiconductors for an example, right? There seems to be some traction with the Japanese. There seems to be some traction with the Dutch, because those are the two, and also with the South Koreans, although the South Koreans have been given a pass for the time being on some of their corporate engagement in China over semis. But that's a huge issue, right? That, and that's a critical issue from the perspective of the Biden administration's China policy, is how to slow down China's progress on this front. And the issue, obviously, is that it affects the bottom line of Japanese, but more importantly, Dutch companies, ASML, to be. And I think that's a significant and will be an important test case as to how the U.S. can begin to. Because, again, back to your point, we're only a superpower if we have strong allies. And on issues like this, we need our allies to be with us as we try to constrain, contain China on this issue, because of its significant potential military application. And it's also, it raises questions about China's control of the supply chains as well.
John, moments ago, you talked about the unpredictability of China. And we have this guy, Xi Jinping, in charge. Some call him the chairman of everything. He has consolidated the most power of anyone since Chairman Mao. Nobody knows, but given your knowledge and firsthand experience in China, is that the future we should anticipate with Xi Jinping in charge for the next 10 to 20 years? Or do you think the situation could be much more dynamic?
Given the fact that so much of China is a black box, there is a possibility for some type of dynamic situation. But if I was going to bet, I would bet on continuity right now over dynamic change. And I look at how Xi Jinping, I try to study about how what he's written about how he views the future relations with the United States and with the rest of the Western world. And I think it's very much within what the sort of the context of what one could call cooperation and struggle, with struggle being the most important element to that. And if you look, for example, at the recent China Economic Work Conference report, there's a lot of very sort of pro-Western, pro-foreign business, pro-FDI stuff in there. But in some of the later readouts written, published only in Chinese, that followed the main readout that was published both in Chinese and English, the secondary readouts are like the reminder to the party faithful, hey, we're still in the struggle mode, but we need to cooperate for the time being because our economy right now is in the toilet and we need help. But long term, everybody, we need to be united on the reality that the long term, this is a struggle, but we're only cooperating strategically because we need the help so much. Now, they, in their reports, blame external forces for the problems their economy is facing, even though in reality, one could argue that it was zero COVID that put the, you know, the nails in the coffin of the Chinese economy for the time being. But cooperation and struggle, I think, is how Xi looks at the world, with the emphasis being long-term struggle, specifically with the United States.
Until such time that China emerges as the undisputed superpower, the leader, the center.
I also believe that Xi Jinping, if you read what he writes, is a deep believer that he has inherited the mantle of communism and socialism from the Russians to Mao to him. And he's a believer in socialism, not socialism a la Bernie Sanders, socialism a la Lenin and Stalin. And he does believe in the
big difference.
That big difference. And he believes in the superiority of that system. And and he wants to see that system win in the end against the liberal democracy and the liberal ideas of the West.
So when he goes to bed at night, what do you imagine he thinks the United States comes into his mind? What does he think?
How to get around the increasing number of restrictions that the Biden administration is placing on his economy because of the Biden administration's concern that over the course of time, and specifically starting with the WTO, that the Americans have helped create a monster. And now we have to try to put the genie back in the bottle, and it's very difficult. And he wants to get around those restrictions. And he does so by reaching out to foreigners to invest more in his country in order to weaken foreign political unity against China, and also in order to create dependencies that he then can leverage later on.
We've seen the United States go from basically kind of head in the sand post-WTO. This is great. China's going to come around and join our party. They'll be one of many nations in the economic establishment we've created, to today a pretty focused offensive to say, hey, China is actually challenging us, is a serious threat to us. How do you feel about the U.S. stance and what could we be doing better?
So I think that the Biden administration basically inherited the Trump administration's policies that were created effectively by Matt Pottinger, his deputy national security advisor. And I think that they've added to them in that they've brought our ally. They came to the realization that our allies had to be brought along. And they've had some benefit, you know, some results. So the example would be the semiconductor space as well. I think on some areas they're not sweating it so much, which is a good thing, because I think a full court press on every area in the relationship is unnecessary. Mm-hmm. So I think they're trying to take a little bit more of a targeted perspective and focus on technology and not focus on just, you know, Americans investing in the A-share market in China and things mm-hmm. like that, which I think is important. Because if you try to kill everything, it's unnecessary, right? Cooperate where you can, but competition really needs to be targeted and successful. And not scattered.
It's real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the issue is, like, you know, how are they trying to help transform the U.S. economy and bring some supply chains to the United States, or relocate them into nations which are more attuned to the interests of America? And that's an open question. So in the EV space, which is your expertise, you know, how's the Inflation Reduction Act going to help create opportunities, even for Chinese companies that are, you know, good actors? I mean, this is an open question as well. How the U.S. responds to that, I think, will be also a key determinant in the relationship.
Right. Do we welcome the battery makers from China into the United States, bring money, bring their technology, manufacturing, jobs, tax revenues locally, and all the rest? Or are they Trojan horses? We don't know. That's what they're debating right now.
Right. Yeah. And then the complicating issue is the Uyghur Forced Labor Protection Act. Mm. Do these companies have a significant profile in Xinjiang? How does that affect, you know, their desire to open up a factory in Sydney, Ohio? You know, all these questions really need to be dealt with.
John, I remember before the first time we met, it was at a dinner hosted by Ken Wilcox up in San Francisco. Ken had spoken so very highly of you, and we know why. There are a few people I've met in my life who know China better, and I hope the Biden administration is calling you weekly, daily, for guidance on how to navigate these coming months and years, because they're fraught with danger, no question about it. There's, in the words of Susan Shirk here in San Diego, there's the war has already started. It just hasn't. We haven't had the shots fired, but on so many other fronts. China and the United States are digging in. So,
indeed. Well, Michael, it's a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. Last question for you. John, how do people learn more about you and, importantly, buy your books?
Twitter, J-E-P, Pomfret, J-E Pomfret on Twitter, as long as it's going to be around. You never know what Musk is going to do tomorrow. You know, my books are all on Amazon, so you can give Jeff Bezos a portion of the revenue.
And you have a site, I think, called John Pomfret.
JohnPomfret.com, yes.
.com.
Yeah.
Very useful, very easy to use. The books are there, your quotes are there, your Twitter feed's there. So
that's
another good spot.
Excellent.
All right, John. Thank you again, Michael, for taking time to join us on the Driving with Dunn podcast. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure, and all the best for Zozo Go.
Thank you.
Take care.
When you think about it, listen to John, you come to realize that Poland is such an important ally to the United States, arguably more so than ever before. For example, had Poland remained a Russian ally, the people of Ukraine would today be squeezed by enemies, Russia to the east and Poland to the west. That would change everything. Two, Poland's spy veterans give the United States immeasurable knowledge about how things work in communist regimes. From China to North Korea to Cuba, this used to be a no-go zone for the U.S., but now we have insights. And three, Poland gives Western European countries like France and Germany and Italy a reality check. Hey guys, life under Russian or Chinese influence is no picnic. Hey, if you enjoyed this episode, take a moment to share it with your friends. Give us a 5-star rating. Send us a DM with comments. I am Michael Dunn, and this is the Driving with Dunn podcast.
Thank you for listening to Driving with Dunn. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. And to reach Michael Dunn, go to zozogo.com.